From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is The Exchange. Today, we continue our series on energy-efficient living. We'll hear from a man who has one of the most remarkable homes around. Gregory Johnson lives in a tiny Iowa City home that is just 140 square feet, and that's on two floors. But Gregory Johnson is also the founder and director of Resources for Life, an outreach organization dedicated to better living through more efficient products and services. One man's radical approach to efficient living. That's coming up on The Exchange after this news. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we continue our series that looks at energy-efficient living. You may have heard of Gregory Johnson. He lives in a small... No, small is too big a word. What I have to say is a tiny home. Your kitchen may well be larger than his entire house. His mobile hermitage, that's what he calls it, is just 140 square feet. That's not one room, that's everything. And it's gained him national media attention. But he's much more than a guy who lives in a tiny house. Gregory Johnson is the founder and director of Resources for Life. That's an outreach organization based in Iowa City. And if you go to their website at resourcesforlife.com, you'll find a whole host of groups and services dedicated to their motto, which is better living through quality products, services, and other resources on and off the net. I began by asking Gregory Johnson to expand on this motto.
Most simply, I guess Resources for Life was the domain name that I chose to use for my website at the time, which was about 7 years ago. At that time, I was primarily working in computer support, technology support, and yet I didn't want to narrow my website that I would eventually be putting years of effort into. I didn't want to narrow that domain name to something like, you know, gregfixescomputers.com or something. So with other interests in mind, I created this name Resources for Life, and I thought, well, that should cover just about everything. So it's now grown into a rather expansive website, which includes information about health and finance, career, relationships, what I call life ways. Another word for that might be different religions, but I look at them as life ways. And the emphasis behind the website in the recent years, I guess I would say, is to provide information on and off the internet and products that might be on and off the internet to equip primarily social activists. Maybe what comes to mind right now to the listener is, oh, are those like the Greenpeace people that get on boats and block whaling ships? But, you know, activists can be just about anybody. Somebody that works for Habitat for Humanity is an activist. Mennonites that work on food and relief projects, I consider them activists. So people who are actively involved in having a positive impact in our society, I refer to them as activists. They're sort of like the white blood cells of our world. And so what I found in my years of sort of exploring activism and socially beneficial outreach efforts is that oftentimes as activists, we get caught up in the cause, in whatever we're passionate about. And many things tend to take a back seat because we feel, and rightfully so, that whatever we're working on at that moment is very important. If we're working at the crisis center or if we're working, you know, feeding the poor or working down in, you know, areas hit by Katrina, that type of thing, you get very focused on the urgency of the need. So as a result of that, initially, I think what people experience is a great feeling of much accomplishment. You dedicate 80 hours a week to the cause, you see so much getting done, but that can't last for too long, right? So eventually, someone's health starts to deteriorate. They're not eating as well as they should. They're not getting the sleep they need. Maybe their finances are going sour, you know.
You're talking about the person who is a social activist.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And this also, we've heard of this happening to people in, you know, church and ministry, that type of thing, where they spend so much time with their church activities that suddenly their family is suffering for it, or their finances are suffering for it, or their life eventually starts to erode, the foundation collapses, and we've heard of some of these stories even recently. So with those things in mind, the thought was then to have this resourcesforlife.com website as an online tool for helping people expand into a life that is more holistically balanced. So the activist who feels those pressures of the needs of people coming into the crisis center, as an example, can still check themselves and say, hey, wait a minute, I know there's some needs at the office today, but I really have to spend at least a half an hour on the treadmill and just, you know, get that workout in as a method of stress management. I'm going to be more effectively available and able to help the people that I care about or work on the causes that I'm working on. If I'll take that time away from it, it's counterintuitive in some ways, I think, for our mind to think this way. But, you know, if we'll take a little bit of time away from the urgency of the cause and simply go for a walk or exercise or give a little thought to some of the food we're eating, maybe take some time in reading poetry or some sacred texts or something like that, that ultimately the theory is that we become more effective and that we're able to better serve the causes and the people that we care about.
So holistically balanced in this case on the individual level means getting a person to a point where they're living a life that is sustainable and they're at their optimum performance.
Right.
Well, let's go back to one of the mottos, one of the key phrases I find in Resources for Life, simple, sustainable living. Tell me what that means in practice.
I think for some people, simple, sustainable living has to do with maybe the environment or politics or possibly even a spiritual walk. There are people who give up their possessions and live on very little to focus on a spiritual pursuit. Those are all valuable reasons for pursuing simplicity, I think, and probably those are partially influencing my desire to be more simple. But I think what people can identify with and connect with is the idea that simplicity really is more efficient and effective, that clutter often limits our abilities to get our work done. So the way that's lived out, I guess, in my life, as I've seen it lived out, is first, the first step for me was to get rid of my television set. And one might think, well, what does that have to do with simplicity? But the television set is kind of the floodgate of all of the materialism, you know, that we're thought to believe in. And I just went ahead and got rid of the TV set, or I should say initially it was, you know, canceling the cable service. I still would selectively choose to watch a video of some sort. But at least the programming, now I was the programmer. And I think that's significant. You know, first you want to become the programmer of your own life and your own mind and your own reality to some extent. Because, you know, we talk about television programming or radio programming. In the case of television programming, I know from working with computers, you can program a computer, but you can't program a TV set.
You know, but you can choose which channels you watch and at what time. So you are, even if you have cable or a regular terrestrial TV, you can be the master of your own schedule, right?
And I mean, with digital recorders, that's becoming more and more possible. And with video downloads available through sources like the iTunes Music Store, you know, I think people are now wanting more and more, and the internet has influenced this as well, people are wanting to control their information, and that's becoming more possible now. So for me, though, I found in, you know, 10 years ago, let's say, getting rid of the television set, there weren't other options available. Whatever a person wanted to watch was basically, you know, what's on one of the channels. And I found that advertising really influenced my sense of what was normal and what was necessary to live in terms of my food consumption and choices and transportation and clothing and the home I would live in. By getting rid of the TV set back then, and I guess we could say just conscientiously thinking about the information that was flowing into my life, at that point, I began to reconsider what I really needed to be happy. So on a practical level then, I began eliminating things that I found weren't absolutely necessary. The car was probably the first thing that I really benefited from getting rid of. I still use a vehicle from time to time. I can borrow a car for, you know, a longer trip. But what I tried to do was live closer to town. So initially I rented a small apartment close to downtown Iowa City and found that the bike was just fine, that most of the client work I do as a technology consultant and the work I do for the university can all be done from a bicycle.
And I have to vouch for you saying that, you know, it's the dead of winter here. We're well below freezing, and you arrived at our studio bundled up and well-equipped on your bicycle for the winter Iowa weather here.
Yeah, people ask about that. They say, you're biking in the winter, you know. I've actually been out in, with the wind chill, what is 30 below zero. And once you're bundled up and you're active, it's actually not too bad. I find that I enjoy biking in the wintertime more than in the summertime, because in the wintertime, it's more difficult to work with a vehicle. You know, it gets snowed in or the windshield's iced over. A bike, you can just get on and go.
Tell me, going back to you mentioned getting rid of the TV and how that defines what life is and what's worth living and what you want to have. Did you find that 10 years ago after getting rid of the TV that your values, your desires, how your life was defined changed because you didn't see all those advertisements?
Yeah, I think so. I think really disconnecting oneself from pre-programmed media that has kind of a corporate influence allows oneself to blossom and grow in unique ways that wouldn't otherwise be possible. To some extent, mass media, and that is, you know, producing a show and delivering it to millions of people, is to society what in Iowa we have diversity of agriculture. There's corn and there's beans. So, you know, mass media is to society what, you know, mass agriculture is to the environment. You know,
monoculture or...
Yeah. And so everybody starts to wear the same clothing. Everyone starts to eat at the same restaurants that are the same that have, you know, from coast to coast. So our thinking, our living becomes kind of stagnated and kind of not as diverse as it might otherwise be.
On the other hand, you know, back when we had three network channels and PBS growing up, that was something I felt that bound us together.
Yeah, no, I think that's very important that we do live in an information society. And I notice occasionally I'll feel out of the loop or not quite connected with my peers if everyone's talking about some show they watched on TV, mm-hmm. some regular show that's on every week, and I think, well, what am I missing out on? So what I try to do is, of the flood of media that's now out there, I try to selectively pick and choose what I'll be listening to.
Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange are now available at iowapublicradio.org. And of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime by email. Our email address is theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. I'm speaking with Gregory Johnson. He's the founder and director of Resources for Life, an outreach organization based in Iowa City. To find out more, you can find his website, resourcesforlife.com. Tell me about something that you'll also find listed at the Resources for Life website, the Technology Services Resource Group. What's that about?
Ever since the late 1970s, actually, when I was in high school, I began to get an interest in computers. And so at an early age, I would have been in high school at that time, I began doing a little bit of programming and playing around with computers. In the early 1980s, I was an undergraduate at the University of Iowa. Still having this interest in computers, I started working at the university as a student, but providing computer support in one of the computer labs back then, back when the floppy disks were actually floppy. You know,
they could bend them, right?
Yeah, you could bend them, 5 1/4-inch disks. So what I realized was that with my interest and I guess a certain skill or knack with technology is that that would be a great field for me to go into. And I began, even as a student, doing some consulting work back then. And that has bloomed into what is now the Technology Services Resource Group. Also behind that, I should mention, is this idea of doing some sort of consulting work, having a business that's fairly profitable, and then using that money for public interest projects. So Resources for Life, somebody might go to that website and think, well, how is this possible? I mean, there's consumer defense, there are these different websites there within a website, there's a small house society. How does all of this get funded? So rather than going to the public and saying, hey, can you donate another $20 this year? We really need your support. What I do is go out and fix a computer and earn $20 for fixing the computer, not literally, but... So rather than going out and doing traditional fundraising, what I do is I have this skill that I can go and set up networks, purchase computers, set up computers for people, and they pay me for that, and consulting pays well. So with that income, then I'm able to support the financial needs of Resources for Life.
So Resources for Life, is that a one-man operation, you?
Yeah, basically.
It sounds, when we talk about groups and all these things, when I look at the website, I think there's an army back there keeping this thing going.
Well, that's kind of what it looks like. It's funny, sometimes I'll be doing some work somewhere. I do some work for the local United Nations Association office here. And I met somebody at a meeting, and they said, well, I thought you worked up in Cedar Rapids, because I was also doing some volunteer work up in Cedar Rapids over the past year. And somebody else would say, well, no, I thought you worked over at the library, because I do some teaching at the public library. So, you know, people see me in all these different venues, and they're confused as to how can it be there's this one person who seems to be everywhere. So maybe that's the key to effective and simple living.
Or cloning.
Cloning, yeah. But, we've heard the term of outsourcing in the corporate world, and I try to outsource quite a bit of what I do. I am, definitely the webmaster of the resourcesforlife.com website. But I certainly wouldn't take credit for all of the content that's there. People do contribute links and ideas that help me develop the website. So that's why I tend to frame it in terms of being a larger organization. And there are people on the mailing list, certainly of hundreds of people, that are around the world, and they contribute their own writings and ideas to me, and I consider those in the development of the website. So.
The resourcesforlife.com services are run by you, as you mentioned. You're the webmaster. This is all run from your very small home, your tiny home. This is something that has garnered a lot of media attention. Television, numerous national magazines have talked about Gregory Johnson, the man who lives in 140 square feet. Run something or is involved with something called the Small House Society. And this house exists here in Iowa City. You slept there last night. You had breakfast there this morning, I assume.
That's right. actually, I didn't have breakfast there this morning, though. Usually my morning routine involves waking up, if I can, around 5 or 5:30 and getting to the gym by maybe 6 or 6:30. So I get in my workout before I eat. And then I also shower at the gym, so I don't really need to have the shower facilities at home.
Give us a radio tour in our mind's eye of your home, if you could take us through the front door.
Sure. When we walk in the front door, and the front door faces north, which I'm told has some significance. I didn't plan it that way, but somebody told me it's very good, it's very auspicious to have your home pointing north. But anyway... walking in the door, to the right is the kitchen area, and to the left is a study that's built into the wall, essentially. There's a desk with bookshelves on the left and the right of the desk in the study area, and a window that overlooks the desk area. So the windows are placed thoughtfully close to the areas where somebody would want lighting during the day, and the plan would be at night you would just not use electricity because you'd be sleeping. So... And then straight ahead from the entrance is a very large window that looks south and provides quite a view of the front yard. So.
Mm-hmm. And then you go up some stairs, and a loft area, sort of the peak of the house, is your sleeping area.
Right. And that's a very efficient use of that space. That would be a 10x7 bedroom, essentially, and the downstairs is 10x7, so that's how we arrive at the 140 square feet. In the bedroom... there's seating room only, essentially. You can't stand up there because the peak of the roof is maybe 4.5 feet or something. But once a person's asleep, you don't really care if you have a 4-foot ceiling or a, you know, 14-foot ceiling. And that ends up being then a useful use of that space up there in the loft area.
What about when you want to have guests?
I invite guests, but they must be very tiny. No,
You ask them on the phone before they come over. Now, are you tiny?
Yeah. No, they need to be close friends, very close friends. But yeah, my my girlfriend, the woman I was dating a few years ago, would stay over from time to time. And we didn't feel too closed in, actually. There, you could probably have 2 or 3 extra people in the house, but it does get kind of cramped.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to, I guess, a discussion about, I mentioned outsourcing. What I try to do really is outsource my entire home. I used to live in a 2,000 square foot home and used really just about every inch of it. I think I tried to use it efficiently. But what I found was that I didn't really need to own my own exercise equipment, for example. So by eliminating that 10 by 14 foot room in my house where I had all of the exercise equipment and going to the gym instead, that really alleviated for me a lot of stress, really. The stress of maintaining your own equipment and when it breaks, replacing it and going and shopping around for that stuff. So now when I go to the gym, there's somebody there cleaning the equipment, taking care of it. I don't really have to think about anything. I just go there, get in my workout, shower, and leave. And there are other areas of my home as well that I've outsourced. Now, we were talking about running the entire Resources for Life operation out of the tiny house. And certainly, you know, much of the work I do is done in my office at the university or in another office I have here in Iowa City. So I haven't totally become independent of electricity and, you know, fossil fuel or anything. And I try not to convey that to people. I want to be clear that it's really, it's my home that I live in where I've been able to simplify. And depending on my vocation, the needs at home wouldn't really change. I would just go to a different office if I were to work somewhere else. But when I get to work, certainly I'm using computers every day. I'm helping other people with their computers, spend a lot of time on the internet. I do have wireless at home, and I could, and sometimes do, use a portable notebook computer and hook up to wireless from a neighboring home with permission. So, yeah.
Now, I guess I don't know what your position is at the university.
Computer support, technology support.
Okay.
And I've been working with the university on and off since 1983, I guess, in sort of the same kind of position.
Consulting.
Consulting, computer support. I spent about a year and a half at the College of Law maintaining the network there. And at the time, I was the only support person for about 500 users, so that was exciting. Mm. And spent some time at the computing center, the Weed Computing Center. Also worked at the hospital a little bit, and now I'm in languages.
I want to pause to mention that this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. You call this mobile hermitage is your title for your home, your name for your home. It has wheels.
Right. I'm not
sure. Do you ever move it?
Well, no, I don't. And I suppose there's something sort of laughable about the idea of a mobile hermit. I mean, who's, you know, the hermit that goes on Oprah or something. What is that?
If your hermit needs to escape from the masses, you can be, you know, hermits like to be alone, I guess.
That's right. So I don't know why I've called it the mobile hermitage, but it has generated some email from people who are actually seeking hermitages or retreats, and people have an interest in it for that reason. They see it as the ideal kind of Buddhist meditation retreat or something.
How much energy does it use compared to, say, your 2,000 square foot home that you used to live in?
It could probably run on no energy. The energy sources I currently use are a little gas tank that's the same as what you might use on a gas grill, if you can imagine. I think they call it a 20-pound container. So that,
right.
That little white tank that's
the thing I have on my barbecue.
Yeah, on the barbecue. That is what I use to heat the entire house for weeks and weeks on end. Just a very small flame right now, actually. It's running at home. And it doesn't...
That keeps you warm enough.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Very comfortable. And so, what does it cost to refill one of those? $14 or something. So, you know, every 3 or 4 weeks, I refill that heating fuel container, and that's the total of my expense in the wintertime.
That I just got my gas and electricity bill. That sure beats the heck out of my bill. This small house, your mobile hermitage, was designed and built by a man named Jay Schaefer. And now this is expanded. He builds these for a living?
Right. I think other than his first home, which he built for himself, and my home being, I believe, the second small home that he built, I would have been essentially his first customer.
Also someone here in Iowa, Jay Schaefer? Does he live in Iowa?
He used to live here in Iowa City and worked with the university. He was in the art department and now is living out in California running his business, which is the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company.
Very nice.
Yeah. And he's been on the CBS Evening News. He's also received a lot of media coverage, which is interesting. You would think something like the topic of small houses really wouldn't generate that much interest. But for some reason, it has. And several years ago, if a person were to do a Google search on small house, not in quotes, but just small house, it would have generated maybe, a few thousand results. Today, there are, depending on the day that you do the search, over 200 million results for a search on small house on Google.
Hmm.
And the Small House Society is actually the very first website that comes up. So we're happy about that.
Now, how much would a house like this cost? What you have to throw in is the investment.
Yeah, $15,000 to $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically the price of a car, and the payoff time would be about the same. You can basically purchase, build, and own a house, and have it paid off in about 3 years.
We have to be concerned too, since we're in an area that is frequented by tornadoes. That this is something that, if you lived in a mobile home, you have the same concerns in a small house like this.
That's right. The advantage of having a small home that is built by hand is that you can use residential or even commercial grade windows, doors, and siding. I chose to use half-inch thick cedar, which would be cost prohibitive in a 3,000 square foot home. But when you're looking at a 10 by 7 home, you can go with the higher grade materials, which is a real advantage. And in our recent tornado, actually this year that hit, there wasn't a direct strike, but a block away, a fairly sizable tree was pulled up by its roots. And so there was some, extra heavy wind in our neighborhood. And the home held up pretty well. It's held up through 3 years of Iowa storms and summers. So
this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We'll be right back. I'm speaking with Gregory Johnson. He's the founder and director of Resources for Life, an outreach organization based in Iowa City. To find out more, you can find his website, resourcesforlife.com. These small homes are playing a part in finding affordable housing for Katrina survivors.
That's right. I think that's part of the interest now. Initially, I moved into the small house thinking, well, this will be a quiet, simple way to live, and it's ended up involving television and radio interviews, and as you mentioned, the New York Times and other magazines have been running stories on the small house. In the case of Katrina victims and other people who have been affected by floods and power outages and other things, which number in the hundreds of thousands of people, I think people are looking for a simpler way of life to assure themselves of continuity. They don't want disruption to their life. And whether it's a power outage, like we saw a very large power outage in LA, and there have been others relating to either storms or winter weather or just poor infrastructure that we have right now, people just don't want that kind of interruption. And so with Katrina victims particularly, they've lost whatever they had. Many of them aren't being taken care of by insurance, so they need to start from nothing. And if you can buy and build a home for about $10,000 to $20,000, that would be a great way to start. And having the home being mobile, I think, gives people a sense of reassurance, knowing that, if there were some threatening storms being warned about in the news, that they could, if they needed to, hook up a truck and pull their house away and, be away from the storm area a day or two ahead of time.
Have these small homes, in fact, found their way to Katrina survivors?
Yes, and there are people in that area, actually. Even Lowe's is, I guess, like Menards. Lowe's is a hardware store that has prepackaged tiny homes that you can buy. And you just, the way I understand it, you go through the checkout register and you say, I like a gallon of milk. And
one home to go.
One home to go. Yeah.
Give me a screwdriver. I'll probably need it.
Yeah.
Any estimate on how many? Do you have any numbers as far as how many?
I don't, and that's a frequently asked question. All I do know as far as numbers is that the number of people interested in our monthly newsletter from the Small House Society, that number has increased into the hundreds. And also an interesting indicator is the internet traffic that we get to the Small House Society website. Some days it's, 5,000 visitors. There was one day, in fact, when a story had aired on NPR, there were 70,000 hits to the website. So there's definitely an interest among people in the small house movement.
Moving into this house, you have lived there how long now?
3 years.
3 years. How has it in 3 years changed your life?
Well, it's interesting you use that phrase, changed your life, and it has. Initially, I was a little bit apprehensive about moving into one of Jay's tiny homes. He was describing it to me, and I thought, well, this might make sense financially because I won't have to pay rent anymore. I can buy this little house. But as he described the 10x7 floor plan, I have to admit I was a little bit startled because the room that I was renting was 10x12. And I thought, I'll be moving from a 120-square-foot room that I was renting into a 10x7 home. But realizing that there were two levels, I soon did the math and realized that, okay, actually, I'll be getting into 140 square feet from what I was living in, a 10 by 12 room. So this will be kind of an upgrade. And so once I got used to that idea and realized also that Jay had manufactured into the home, he had designed into the home tables that fold out from underneath cabinets and, certain ledges that fold down. So there are things that sort of fold out of the woodwork in this house. And it's effectively, I tell people, probably the equivalent to maybe a 500-square-foot home because the kitchen area is quickly converted into a work area, and that's quickly converted into a changing room or whatever one wants to use it for.
And we want to mention here to our listeners that if you'd like to get a look at one of these small homes, go to resourcesforlife.com. In fact, there's a video there of a TV report touring Gregory's home here in Iowa City. You can look at how efficiently that space is used and see some pictures of this small home, the Mobile Hermitage. Does it ever get, now be honest here, does it ever get to be a pain where you stand up one day, you hit your head on a beam and you get up into your loft to go to sleep and you say, I'm dreaming of that 2,000-foot home that I used to have. Wouldn't it be nice to have a ping pong table in your own home? Are there moments like that?
Well, you can get those tiny gardens, stone gardens, and I'm sure there's a tiny ping pong table that's 3 inches by 5 inches or something. No, actually, this month I was asked by some friends, they offered their home for me to stay in.
Right.
And it's a 4,000-square-foot home with the jacuzzi and the swimming pool, and the lights are computerized and all of that, the stereo throughout the entire home. And I have done some house sitting for them in the past, but I turned them down this time. I just found that I really do enjoy my tiny house. And even when I have the alternative available for free, even if somebody's, in this case, willing to pay me to live in a $600,000 home, I choose the tiny house because of the simplicity and waking up in the morning. It's like being on vacation. And I often relate this to people that if you were going to go on vacation, you had your 4 weeks, let's say, and somebody gave you a budget of, $50,000, quite often a person would choose to say, what I'd like to do is just get away from the rat race. I'd like to go stay in a little cabin or cottage. And, maybe go, I want to get one of those bicycles and go on, bike paths and really have a vacation, So what I started thinking about was, you could do that every day. You could turn every day into a vacation. Why not live in your, cottage retreat? Just have that be your home. And instead of going on, one bike tour a year and, reminiscing about how lovely that was, that go on a bike tour every day, commute to work on a bicycle, live in your dream vacation home and get rid of the clutter. So,
for at least a couple of generations, houses have been increasing in size dramatically, increasing in size. If we go back to a 1950s era house, typical, which you would see, maybe what is that, 1,000 to 1,500 square feet?
Right.
And now typical is well above that, maybe the 2,000 to 3,000 and above square footage here. So the trend seems to be larger, bigger. Why would there even be an appeal in tiny homes?
I'm thinking that that trend toward larger and bigger is winding down. That's my thought and hope. People now, I think, are increasingly looking for quality rather than quantity. And I think they're looking for quality rather than quantity in every area of life. So rather than having the 3,000 or 4,000 square foot home that looks like it conveys a message of wealth and success, when, you know, in reality, the home is poorly made, poorly constructed. It doesn't have cedar siding. It has plastic siding. That people really want to live in something of quality, and they don't really care about the size as much anymore. One of the driving factors, I think, for people to decide to live in a 2,000 square foot home, let's say, is they think through, and smartly so, they think through the year ahead or the 5 years ahead, the kids that they're going to have, or maybe, you know, they want to have friends and family over for Thanksgiving. That's not going to happen in a 140 square foot home. So when you're buying a home, you think about what are all of the possible uses of it, mm-hmm. and the ping pong table and that type of thing. So, and the same is true, I think, for a vehicle. A lot of people go out shopping for a car and they think, okay, you know, sometimes it's just going to be me going from home to work, and that's a 10-minute drive, and it'll just be me in the car. But other times it might be me and my friends in the car. And there might be an occasion when I'll pull a boat and or an RV. So I can't afford three or four vehicles. I can only afford one vehicle, so I'm going to get one vehicle, and it needs to do all that. And that's how people, I think, end up with an SUV because,
they think of all the possibilities they'll have for the next 5 or 10 years.
Sure, and you might end up going off-road in Montana. I mean, even though you've never done that before, you might, you know.
We'll put that on the list. We might go off-road in Montana.
Could happen.
We need a vehicle for that. Yeah.
The approach I've taken is I realize, you know, I don't need to own an SUV. I don't need to own a forklift. I don't need to own a lot of things. You know, you can rent when you need something like that. Similarly, with a home, rather than foreseeing, you know, oh, well, what about when our kids get married? I bet we'd have 100 people over. We better get a home with that in mind. You know, rather than thinking that way, thinking in terms of outsourcing the house. You know, when you have the wedding reception, you're not going to have that at your house. You're going to have it at the hotel or at the church or something like that. So similarly, you don't need to have a fitness center in your home. You don't need to have a laundromat in your home. You don't really need to have a walk-in pantry if there's a grocery store 5 blocks away. So I think that, you know, thinking this way can help people live in smaller spaces.
What do you see as the chief obstacles in moving toward more sustainable living in the U.S. for the population at large?
Well, you know, interestingly, I think we have some real opportunities here in the U.S. to pursue sustainable living in ways that maybe people in other countries don't have. And what I want to talk about specifically is my experience in living in this tiny home. That would not be possible, probably, in an undeveloped country where I couldn't just walk out my door and in 5 minutes be at the gym or be at a fully stocked, you know, organic grocery store or something. We have the Iowa City Public Library here. We have the university. There are, within a 5 to 10 minute bicycle ride, we have some world-class resources right here in Iowa City for education, for technology, for fitness, health, whatever you want to pursue.
So the community has to be a part of allowing you to live in a tiny home.
Yeah, I think so. And a mentality that, you know, everything isn't going to be privatized, you know, that you can go into public facilities and make use of, as I mentioned, the library or an exercise facility for not much expense. And so that makes it possible for people not to live in the 2,000 to 4,000 square foot home.
So this is at the other end of the spectrum from your gated community. This is open to the rest of the community.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a mindset that has to change in the U.S.? Is that an obstacle?
Well, I think that's part of it. For me, it was. I had a lot of things, and my first step was to move everything into a storage facility. That was the first step. I don't think I could have parted with my possessions right away, but I knew I could distance myself from them. But by living into a smaller space, by moving into a smaller space, one puts upon themselves essentially self-imposed minimalism to some extent. And so the attitude that I think we can move toward here in the U.S. is one of more relying upon community. I find that I'm more social living in a smaller house because
it certainly gets you out of the house.
It gets me out of the house. There's not much to do at home. If I'm, you know, going to, as I say, do the laundry or go exercise or go eat, all of those now become social activities rather than before. Those were very much solo activities. You know, I'd stay at home to eat. I'd stay at home to exercise. I'd stay at home to work even. And so I think people are getting away from that. They don't want to be secluded. They want to be out in the public. And
You've had a tremendous amount of media attention paid to your way of living, your departure from the conventions of living here in the United States. Who are your critics? Do you hear your critics? Do they contact you? And what do they say?
There aren't many of them. I think people aren't intimidated by simple people, you know, like myself. I'm pursuing kind of a simple, quiet lifestyle, so there are probably fewer critics of that than you might imagine. But there was one person who responded with some frustration in an email, and she wrote saying that, you know, well, that living in a tiny house might be fine for you, but you know, for the rest of us who have to live normal lives, you know, we have to have the SUV and the big house. And so I replied and said, I'm living a normal life. I work in a regular job, and it's this is just a simple life I've chosen. I didn't mean to offend anybody by living simply, but
okay. Well, if you had family with the kids, I suppose you'd have to have a less tiny house, perhaps,
or several tiny houses,
or a cluster of tiny houses, a little village. You've had also several South American countries. You've traveled to several South American countries, as well as Israel, Spain, Mexico, and Canada, as part of your study of urban and regional planning with the Higher Education Consortium for Urban Affairs. I want to ask you, how have these travels and these studies of how people live abroad, perhaps differently than us here in the United States, how have these travels broadened your horizons in terms of simple and sustainable living?
Well, they certainly, the traveling and being mindful of how other people live, I think began to stir in me an interest in thinking about urban and regional planning and thinking about how I wanted to live. In South America, certainly, outside of Lima, I remember the city dump was home to quite a few hundred people, as I recall, living in sort of makeshift shacks among the garbage. In other more affluent areas, people didn't live in garbage dumps, but they had sort of propped up plywood and scraps of metal for homes. I remember on one occasion seeing a gentleman coming out of one of these homes that was essentially, as I say, just plywood and scraps of metal put together, and he was wearing a suit and tie, and he had some very nice shoes on. He was dressed better than I was. And that struck me. That was one of those moments where I thought, you know, a person's home doesn't necessarily have to be the biggest investment they make in their life. Now, I don't know what his situation was, but somebody explained to me that the problem really is not that people don't have the money for homes. It's just that the homes don't exist. They haven't been built, and there's a shortage, essentially. But in South America, when I was in Colombia, we were looking at how different people lived in that area. Certainly, there's the larger cities like Bogota, with at that time there were 6 million people living in Bogota. And the smaller communities outside of Bogota would be similar to small communities we have here in the U.S. On one occasion, I remember seeing a community of people, maybe 100 people, they were building a house, a home that they would all live in. It looked like an apartment building, I guess. And I was fascinated by that. They were doing it themselves. They were pouring the cement foundation, and they were pouring the walls were cement with rebar reinforcement. And I knew that even though in the state that I saw it, it looked a little bit, you know, institutional, that, you know, they would finish it off and it would be a nice home for this group of, as I say, you know, maybe 70 or 100 people, number of families that were going to be living in that. And what they did was they had this little community center where they were going to be doing their laundry, and that's where the ping pong table was going to go. And they'd have picnics there and the, you know, the wedding reception or whatever, a huge kitchen with all of the, you know, amenities that you might imagine, rather than duplicating that out to, you know, maybe 30 families or 100 people all having their own ping pong table and their own, you know, very expensive appliances and washer and dryer and that type of thing. They had the intelligence to think ahead and realize, you know, you don't use that every minute of the day. You could probably share that. So that really struck me as something I, you know, made a note to self about that, that I too wanted to have the financial benefit of sharing costs with people, so that if I was going to get a riding lawnmower, for example, instead of it costing $10,000, if I split it 10 ways with 10 other people, then we'd share the riding lawnmower, then suddenly it's 90% off. It's $1,000, you know.
You have also developed what you call a holistic life management system, and something called the Schedule for Life. Tell us about that.
The Schedule for Life and the Life Management System was my effort to put into the public domain some thoughts about time management and life management. The idea behind having a Schedule for Life is to combine essentially a checklist, a daily checklist, that one goes through, but in an effective way. For example, something as simple as brushing your teeth. You know, you want to brush your teeth every day. The most effective time to do that would probably be at night, because you're going to have, you know, 8 hours of time when your teeth are just going to sit there and they'll be all clean. Similarly, exercising. I know people say, well, I'm not a morning person, or I exercise better at 10 o'clock at night. Our physiology, I think, is better served by kind of waking up in the morning. And at least I find, and many people I know find, that if you exercise in the morning, you have a better energy level throughout the day. And that boosted metabolism then is a benefit as well. So if one picks some priority items and schedules them throughout the day in a certain way, you can gain greater impact from those. There's more on the website about the Schedule for Life, but the idea is to have a holistic look at life, to prioritize a few things and do those few things well and consistently.
You are such a unique individual with such unique ideas. You don't conform. Where did this thinking come from?
Well, when I was younger, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my dad at the time became friends with Ralph Nader, and they worked on some projects together. And so we would, on occasion, we would go to have dinner at the Nader's house. And
what was dinner like at the Nader's house? I'm wondering.
I only remember everything from kind of, you know, 3 feet and below. It was I saw the, but you know, it was the context more than anything in specific. The context of growing up in the 70s as a young teenager, being influenced not to be a radical, but to be thoughtful about society and thoughtful about choices. And back then, the big issue was, you know, the Ford Pinto exploding, and that finding out that there was a memo within Ford stating that, you know, it would have cost $1.33 or something to make the car safer, but that it would have cost more money than the lawsuits, you know. And so my mind and awareness became open to the idea that sometimes poor choices are made, and when it's a poor choice on a corporate level, that can, you know, have a negative impact. Recently, there was a report stating that 1 billion people are estimated to die as a result of tobacco-related deaths over the next 100 years. So growing up in the 1970s, I had that influence of an awareness that one should be thoughtful about the choices we make. And I also went to school to Sidwell Friends, which was a Quaker school. And there was some influence then also of...
We have a Quaker school in Iowa. That's not that one.
No, but it's similar to that.
Gregory Johnson, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's been good to be here.
And that's all the time we have for today on The Exchange. The Exchange is produced by Greg Shanley. Our studio engineer is Dennis Reese. Producer assistants, David Henderson and Stephen Caranda. Engineers, Jim Davies and Nate Schultz. Also help from Donald Baxter, Scott Vestos, Phil Moss, and Leonard Tompkins. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.